Hey, y'all. Pretend we're football for the next hour. I'm your host, Will Baser. You guys can find me on Twitter at I'm your host, Will Baser, and I'm joined alongside by Johnny Brashear and Tim Preston, as always. You guys listen to the Hornets Cast channel, which you guys can find on any podcasting platform out there. Today, we're going to be going over the first three games where Texas beat, or where Texas started off 3-0, beating Northern Colorado, Purdue, and Cal Baptist. Tell y'all what we're excited about on a micro and macro level, and what we're worried about on a micro and macro level. Then talk about Purdue, the importance of that game, and going forward, the Empire Classic as Texas takes on Prairie View A&M, Georgetown, and Duke or Cal. Tell y'all what to expect there. A little note before we get going, we're going to be skipping next week just because of how Texas's basketball schedule is set up. But before we get going, y'all, I do want to get y'all's takes on some big college basketball news as Evansville, a small school out of Indiana, took down the number one team in Kentucky. What's y'all's hot take? Why is Evansville the number one team in the nation now?
Well, I just don't think you can really argue it. Hey, you beat the king, you're the king. And Kentucky was, well, no, if you eat at Burger King, it's your way.
You're the new Burger King. New Burger King.
Okay, yeah. So Evans, but
yeah, no.
Do they have Burger Kings in Lexington?
Yeah,
they got every sort of fast food.
They have
in Lexington.
Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Well, I think Evansville hit more
White
three pointers.
They definitely have White Castle. So
yeah. it was a cool game. Like, it was an interesting game to watch before the Texas game. but I just, you know, it's one of those it's one of those things where in some ways it justifies. So it depends on how you think about Texas the last few years. Like, on the one hand, Kentucky losing to Evansville was like, that's objectively bad for Kentucky. Like, they should never lose that game. And it, you know, it's just like Texas should never lose to Radford or whatever. It's like, oh, well, see, even Kentucky loses those kind of games. Like, yeah, well, Kentucky's had a better few years than we have. Right? I mean, so it does happen to everybody, but I wouldn't mind being Kentucky's shoes where a loss to Evansville is truly tragic. But also have some skins on the wall as far as March success in the tournament. So
yeah, well, I think it really, you got a feel for those Kentucky basketball fans because they lost twice in 1 week. Their football team Alabama going down, and now their basketball team Kentucky going down.
And the Cowboys lost. So
oh, and the Cowboys there's... lost, right? And you know, even
and
going
Golden
back,
State
you know,
sucks right now.
Going back to October, you have the Yankees going down on that tragic, tragic walk-off home run from the Astros. It's just those guys have been having a bad month.
We've all read that tweet, Will. I get it.
They're still reeling from Voldemort dropping that final match to Harry. I mean, it's tough.
No, there's no way Kentucky fans would be Voldemort fans. They'd 100% be Harry Potter fans, but only after, like, the fourth book.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, he's clearly the chosen one. Okay, all right, yeah, let's get on this. My take is that fuck Kentucky. Is that... Was that too nuanced?
I think it was a little too hot. That's a little too hot right now, Johnny. I think you need to calm down there.
I don't absolutely hate Kentucky. It's just, it's one of those, like... You guys don't have very much to complain about, but at the same time, I also kind of feel like for the last 24 hours, Texas basketball message boards or board, maybe there might only be one basketball message board, that they're more positive than the Kentucky ones for the last 24 hours or so. So that's, you know, that's a nice diversion or, you know, a move from the mean, I guess. So I'll take these little moments of sunshine where they have to have their existential dread before winning 28 games this season. So
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it was just cool to see Evansville, the party in Evansville. Because every time something like that happens where there's like a big championship or a big win, a big upset, I usually go on Snapchat and zoom in and watch the Snapchats in that area. And those people in Evansville, it was like they had won the freaking lottery. There was partying in the streets. There was just random screaming going around
city. Will, could you explain what Snapchat is to Tim?
So, oh, Tim.
I teach high school seniors. You think I don't know what Snapchat is? Get out of here with that.
Tim, do you have a phone?
Yeah. I'm younger than Johnny.
Does it have a cord on it? Is it a corded phone?
It currently has a cord in it, yes. But my charge game is strong. Now leave me alone. As an objective Texas fan, like I love Texas, but there was something truly magical about when Northern Iowa beat Kansas in the tournament, and like there's just something really, really badass about college basketball underdog teams like mid majors that beat, you know, a really good team. And yeah, I'm sure that Evansville was feeling great. But like, and the MVC is solid. It seems like almost every year some team from the MVC sneaks up and beats a really good team. So congrats to them. Eat donkey dick, Kentucky, and here we go.
Yeah, well, let's get right into Texas's first three games, which they did not drop. So on that note, what has y'all excited about this team after they took care of business with North Carolina, Colorado, Northern Colorado?
Could call them the North Carolina of Northern Colorado.
We're all having trouble saying Northern Colorado.
They're basically same state.
Where are they at? Where is it at? It's
I don't know.
Northern Colorado? That's in
UNC
Greeley, Colorado.
Greeley.
We don't have Jeff Haley on the show to just give us random facts about these teams that nobody knows about. But, Northern Colorado, they took care of business with Northern Colorado. Then they snuck past a Cal Baptist team that kept things too close for comfort. And they also went to Purdue and beat the Boilermakers at home, at their own house. What has you guys excited about this basketball team after these first three games?
You know what has me excited about this is, well, one, they didn't follow up a big non-conference win with a loss to a much lower team. That's nice.
That would never happen, Johnny. I mean, come on.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I know. It's a random happenstance kind of thing. Like, there's, I realize I'm just talking theory here, but I like that. There's a good argument to be made that the Purdue win is the biggest non-conference road win of Shaka's tenure. Like, I don't think there's a lot of argument in that. He's had maybe better neutral site wins in non-conference play, but in terms of actual true road games, no. I mean, maybe the Butler game is in the discussion, but it's not as big a thing to me. So,
yeah.
If we're looking for sort of signposts along the way of, is this Texas team different or are they, is this sort of rinse and repeat? The fact that they went on the road and beat a very solid Purdue team is a good signpost.
Yeah. So I guess I've got three things in particular that stick out to me.
Was I supposed to have like two more?
Johnny, did you not get the memo?
No, I didn't. I'm sorry. I didn't look at the Google Doc.
Yeah, we have cover sheets on the TPS reports now.
Son of a bitch. All right. Sorry. Continue, Tim. I'm going
to
scribble some things.
Didn't you get that memo? So, no, I think the three things that stick out to me the most are the defense is good. And actually, you know, as we kind of break down some of the games a little bit more in depth here as we move forward, the first couple of games against Northern Colorado and Purdue – there were some
question
marks.
Nobody on this podcast can say Northern Colorado.
Northern Colorado and Purdue. I was surprised at how often we switched on defense and also how random it seemed. So there was some question marks like, do I not understand Jokic's defense? But then to see them play against Cal Baptist, like their communication was already better on defense. They were switching really early and seemed to like understand when they were switching. There were a few times where like, we switched before the offense called for it, but it was the right play. And it's like, oh, that's cool shit. That's cool shit. So that was, I'm really excited about the defense and what it can bring. It's just very solid. Also, I'm excited that it's felt like in every single game so far, this has been an offensive team that when they want to attack the rim, they can. I'd like to see more free throw attempts as far as us getting to the foul line. But every single game, whether it's been through pick and roll, dump offs, or through dribble penetration all the way to the rim or whatever, we've done a good job of that. That's the best offenses that we've had, or the best offensive games that we've had under Shaka have been when we've been able to get lane touches, and it seems like we can do that. At will is kind of a lot to say, but we've been pretty adept at that the first few games. And then lastly, I think our top six guys are just stinking good. Like, I really think the top six players for Texas this year, like, they're good. We got a really strong core group of six, which, you know, I'd like that number to be eight, but I'm not going to scoff at six at this point because every single guy of those six has had some looks already this season where you're like, oh yeah, this is gonna be pretty cool. So I think especially when you factor in the fact that four of those six players are backcourt, maybe you could say five are backcourt players if you incorporate some of Liddell's skill set, but regardless, it's pretty neat to have a team that's got that kind of upper level talent in their top echelon guys.
I think it's probably good that this team is a little more diverse in terms of who is important to overall success, right? Like last year, it was you have to have good games from at least two out of the three of Osikowski, Roach, and Coleman to really make or to have a good shot at winning games in the Big 12. Maybe you could put Ramey in there, possibly. It's kind of dependent on how you define things. But those three were sort of it, and you had to have good games out of at least two of them, or else you probably weren't going to win that game. Whereas this year, there's at least four guys that you just need two of them to have really good to really good games. Coleman, Ramey, Febres, and Sims. Like, out of those four, if you get at least two of them to have, you know, I'll call it a B game, B to A plus game, then you got a good shot at winning that game. So there's a little more margin for error. You know, one of those guys can have a down game. One of those guys can be invisible. You still have the other two show up and do really well, and you got a good shot. So I think that sort of gives you a little more, I don't know, it gives you a little better odds in a given game that you're going to do enough to win a game.
So then let's go ahead and turn this on its head here. On a macro scale, what has y'all worried about this team? And I was going to ask you, why is it the three-point shooting? But they're shooting 30% over the first three games. And even the ones that look bad are like Jace Fabris, who's 6 for 17. That's still 35%. The one guy I would say is bringing that one down is Will Baker. But that's just beside the point. What has y'all worried about this team?
Well, let me speak to I want to talk about the three-point shooting real fast if we can, and why I'm not nervous. There's some stuff I'm nervous about, no doubt about it, but there's some stuff I'm not nervous about with the three-point shooting. The first is, right now we're rocking 11 deep. Like, you know, we're going pretty deep in the lineup, and that's just not going to happen. Like, that's not going to – that will not persist. Or if it does, it will only persist in games that, like, either we're already out of or we're way ahead in. But I think, you know, usually Shaka has been somewhere in the 8, maybe 9 range. So the reason that's kind of important is I think you got a guy like Hepa who's taken a couple of tough looks from 3, and Baker who's missing shots, although we know he can shoot. And even fucking Ham has, I think, at least taken 3 3-point shots at this point. I mean, and oh my God, each as disgusting as the last.
Why? My God, that's like Sims taking a 3 last year. Why?
It's interesting for sure to see. But here's why I'm not nervous about it. I really think that, and Shaka's talked about this publicly, the injury to Ramey during the during the preseason, like before our first couple of games.
Yep.
Like, he's fine, but I really think this team is figuring out what it means to play with two playmakers. And Kerwin certainly was a playmaker last year, but almost always was seemingly a playmaker for himself or a playmaker for Hayes. He was not really a playmaker for Febris in the corner or for Ramey in the corner or for Long in the corner. He would, you know, get into the pick and roll actions, and then he would, you know, either take it all the way to the rim or maybe lob it for someone else. But both Ramey and Coleman are pretty adept at getting lane touches and finding open perimeter shooters. And I think that right now we're still figuring out what that means from the standpoint of like, okay, what is actually a good shot? And there were some shots yesterday in particular, I'm sorry, against Cal Baptist in particular, where it felt like this shot was kind of open, but we can get better looks than some of those three-point shots. Like that Hepa shot where he shot it like 45 feet into the air. We can get a better look than that. And certainly there were three or four Febris 3-point shots. We're like, come on, Jace, we don't need that shit. You know, and I think as they get more comfortable playing with both Matt and Courtney on the ball consistently and how they can both playmake for that, we're going to get cleaner open looks. And maybe it's not at the 13-second mark of the shot clock, but maybe, you know, but they, we can, then we recycle and we can get that again. And so both as the personnel lineups kind of shrink as we get into the season and as they get more and more comfortable playing with Matt and Courtney, I think our shooting prowess will extend because of how capable our point guards are.
Yeah, and I think to that point, as far as three-point shooting is concerned, for I will say 2.5 out of 3 games, I've been largely fine with the process that led to the shot. The only half I have issues with is portions of the first half against Cal Baptist. And it's not all of the 3-point shots by any stretch of the imagination, but ballpark, I'm going to say a third or so of the shots of the 3-point shots in the first half did not feel like a process or a product of proper execution. Like either they were taking it too early or, I mean, I don't want to call it a heat check, but it's like, it just felt like there were some guys who were like, I need to get hot or something. Like it was that you watch this offense and when it is executing the way it is designed to execute, there are multiple passes. There's not a ton of dribbling. There are guys getting open through these passes and these multiple ball screens. And, the three, whether it hits or not, is a less contested or uncontested three. Whereas in the first half against Cal Baptist, it felt like there were some of those that it was more like, well, I'm just going to get this shot up rather than the product of an offensive system. That got cleaned up, I think, in the second half. And I think you can see it not only in the make percentage, but in the shot selection. But that's sort of that was the one half I felt like was an issue.
And I'm with you. And I think that it's we need to juxtapose all of that with the fact that over the last couple of years, there were times where some of the shots we were putting up yesterday actually would have been the best looks that we could get out of our offense. But that's not true anymore. You know, like a couple of years ago, some of those Jace three-pointer shots were like, oh, yeah, I guess that's probably about as good as we can hope for. That's not the case now. So as we figure out what's a good shot for this offense, what does that extra pass or two mean for this offense and what we can get, I think the percentages will go up.
Well, I think there's something to be said that there is they already have a pretty well-defined idea of what is a quote-unquote good shot. It is getting to that shot that I think they're doing a better job of overall this year compared to last year. But it is, I mean, we're, 10% of the way into the season and there's still kinks being ironed out. There's still freshmen that are trying to figure out their role, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not super concerned about it, but it is something to monitor, I guess, to see if it improves or not.
So let's go ahead and get into what you guys are worried about with this team. If it's not the shooting, what is it?
Macro. Okay. My macro that I'm worried about is the bigs. Not Jericho Sims, everyone else who is a big, conceivably. Jericho has had I'm going to call it an improved season, but if he gets in foul trouble, we're what, Royce Hamm and Will Baker? And so far, neither of them has really done much for me. So my concern is the front court, if Jericho Sims exhibits foul trouble, which he inevitably will just because of sort of the nature of the beast. Like if he puts together a performance where he gets 2 fouls in the first 2 minutes, like he's done many times in the past, what happens?
And you mean that from like a rebounding standpoint, like what they're able to do from rim protection, rebounding or
rebounding, rim protection, offensive production, like it's just so unproven at this point. Cause like right. You look at Royce Hamm and I know he's the energy guy, but his energy is sort of unfocused and blasted in every single possible direction, which is how you get 5 fouls in 14 minutes in Purdue. And Will Baker is a freshman as highly touted as he is, he's still acclimating to D1 basketball. So I think he'll get better as the season goes on. How much better, we'll see. But that's at that point, like, basically that's a big concern for me, because if Jericho Sims is not as good as he was against Cal Baptist, and or B, deals with foul trouble a lot, we're going to have a multitude of issues that stem from that position if Ham and or Baker do not assert themselves as, I am a viable option for 10 to 16 minutes a game.
Yeah, I still have hope that Baker will be that guy. I'm sure you do too. But yeah, we're quite a ways off from improving it. Yeah, I think that the two things for me, although rebounding and rim protection are up there, I just, broken record, I'm nervous about the almost complete lack of free throw attempts. It just feels like we're, you know, it's tough to have to rely so consistently on getting points in the flow of the offense without at least a decent amount of your points coming off of the foul line. You know, that's just such an easy way to get points when you can rely on it, and we just sort of can't. And part of that is, we've had post-up looks, what, 4 or 5 times in 3 games? I mean, there have been very small snippets of that. So that's kind of tough. And Ramey and Coleman have done a good job of getting into the rim. But they're, you know, you don't really have to help off of them because we're not rolling with our big men a whole lot. So we'll see what happens. But I'd like to see more of that. I'm nervous about that when we get into Big 12 play, because some of the defenses we're going to see will be tough. And then the other part will just be, we've really struggled with some turnovers, particularly early in games. So those are the two for me.
Well, I mean, I guess it free throws come from lane penetration, from generating contact, and this team shoots a pretty large number of three-pointers. So if they're going to continue to be a prolific three-point shooting team, maybe or may not be a three-point making team, we will see. They're not going to generate the contact, generally speaking. So free throws are going to be less of a factor or less of a selling point in this offense, unless they continue to try and make the sort of lane penetration that you're talking about with Coleman and Ramey.
Well, I agree. Yeah. But I mean, so I think Ramey scores, what, 12 of the first 16 points in the second half yesterday.
Something like that.
And I believe all 12 of them were inside the lane, and he took 0 free throw attempts inside that same time frame.
Well, so, yeah, but I mean, if he's not playing against Cal Baptist, there's probably more fouls involved.
Yeah, maybe so.
So let's go ahead and get to the more micro stuff. Which players are you most excited about after these first 3 games?
Matt Coleman. Honestly, like I'm not going to call it concerns about Matt Coleman. It was more, I wanted to see how he would perform in this offense, because he is sort of, historically speaking, when he was recruited to Texas, it was, you're going to be the guy. You're going to be the ball dominant floor general type of guard. And this offense is not so much that. I mean, he is making decisions. He is setting up certain parts of plays and whatnot. But he also can play off the ball, and Courtney Ramey can have the ball. Liddell handles the ball a little bit. Jones handles the ball a little bit. So it's sort of decentralized, right? So last year, Coleman had some issues with sort of consistently imposing his will in games. And through the first 3 games, I feel like he has taken ownership of his position. He is being more decisive with the ball. He is setting up plays in a specific way that benefits him, and or like if Sims is rolling to the basket with him or that sort of stuff. Like, I just feel like he has a lot of control. He's being very effective, whether he is the guy with the ball or he is off the ball. Like, I like his all-around game the first 3 games of the season.
Me too. You know, I
Tim,
guess
that's cheating. You need to pick somebody else other than Matt Coleman.
pick
I guess
Ramey.
My head says Liddell, just because he really gets the game. He sees the floor so well. He moves the ball very well. And I just think he's a guy that can just bring a lot of options to you as a team. But man, my heart says Andrew Jones. In my wildest dreams,
hell yeah.
I'm so excited for him. I'm just like for him. Like every basket he makes, I'm like, oh yeah, that's way to go, Andrew Jones. Oh, it's good for Texas too. Woohoo! But I'm just so geeked for him, just because it's fucking awesome. It's just an incredible thing.
Texas was up by how much was it? 20 points on on Northern Colorado. And I was cheering the entire – I was there for the entire game because I wanted to see Andrew Jones get above 20 points. That was it.
And he was hunting for that dunk at the end of the game against Cal Baptist, and I was just fucking eating it up. I was like, let's fucking go. You know, it's just really cool. And he's playing well. His defense has been terrific. I mean, terrific. He obviously spent, you know, his time away from the team like training and studying film and understanding kind of like nuances and technique and stuff like that, which he was a good defender his freshman year. He's really good. And as his body kind of gets there, not only will his offense get better, but I think his defense will lead to more steals. And so, yeah, Liddell has been very impressive. I'm so jazzed about Andrew and what he's been able to do in these first three games.
So then on the other end of the spectrum, what are you worried about? Who are you worried about?
Rebounding? Can we talk about rebounding?
Did we not already talk about rebounding?
Did we already talk about this?
We're rocking micro with players right now.
Oh, okay. Rebounding with bigs. rebounding with smalls. I'm going to be a mild amount of contrarian with Tim in that, if this offense is designed around creating openings, creating space by east-west movement, by moving the ball around the perimeter and, you know, sort of probing the lane and it just, you know, various ways to create a bit of space here and there, there are two guys who the ball seems to stick to more than others, and it is Andrew Jones and Gerald Liddell, both of whom... I agree with him that I like their, with Liddell, I will call it his potential. With Andrew, I like his progress. But in terms of this particular offensive style, the space is created with pace, moving the ball with passing, moving it, you know, making quick decisions, passing. And I watch it. And with Jones, the ball slows down a little bit compared to Coleman and Ramey, for example. And honestly, I think this might be one of the reasons why Jones is, you know, the sixth man or seventh man as opposed to a starter. And with Liddell, my issue is that sometimes it feels like he has predetermined his decision of what he's going to do before he actually starts making his move.
So literally, like you're just saying the exact opposite of what Tim is saying. Is that what I'm getting at here?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Okay.
This podcast is, or this particular episode is me just telling Tim he's an idiot. So
cool. Got it. Got it. Cool.
All right. There you go. So
I'll rebuke the Liddell doesn't move the ball.
No. Like, so let me make sure I'm specific with this, because we're going micro, right? I got to be specific. my issue is that Liddell, if he gets the ball on the perimeter, there are times in which it seems like he says, I'm going to go work my way down into a post-up sort of move, and I'm going to shoot the ball, and regardless of what the defense is doing. And some of this is, I mean, he is a sophomore who has very little actual playing time, and he's got to learn this sort of thing. He's got to learn to read the defense, and I don't think he's doing a lot of that yet when it comes to that sort of specific play. I think he is used to being a slasher, and he is used to getting to the rim, and people are going to start keying on this, so he needs to learn how to read that and kick out to the open guy, and I don't think he does that often enough yet. This is a fairly mild critique, to be fair. Like, I like his general direction. I understand the potential. I understand why Shaq is raving about him. I think he very much has earned his spot in the starting lineup. But I have spotted that on more than a couple of occasions where it's like his eyes are down on the floor because he is barreling towards the rim in whatever form or fashion, rather than keeping his eyes up and going, oh, you know, Jones or Febres or whoever is open in the corner, or Coleman is about to do a back cut or whatever, right? Like that's a micro thing about him that I have concerns about that I hope gets alleviated.
Quick counterpoint. It's Gerald's like seventh real game.
Sure.
Because he played basically five games last year.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Like it's something I hope that gets better over time, that gets better with reps, that gets better with comfort in the offensive system. But if we're talking about micro concerns, this is one of my micro concerns for a starting guy to predetermine his reads, as it were.
My micros, there's two in particular. We need Will to see the ball go in the basket, and I get nervous that every game that doesn't happen, his minutes don't get elongated early enough. I think he's going to be good, but I really would prefer him to hit some shots early on this season, so let's see that. My other is, if this team is going to come close to maximizing, we need Jace to make better decisions with his shot selection, and he should not be taking some of the shots that he has. So if he in particular is the most needs the most time getting used to playing with Matt and Courtney at the same time, okay, that's cool. Like, I get it. But some of the shit against Cal Baptist was like, those were truly just not good. And he can't be making those decisions. Even if he's hunting his shot, like, you can hunt your shot and not take those shots. Like, those were just dumb. So there's so much video footage of, like, what is a makeable shot for him and what is not. So he needs to kind of shore that up. And I, you know, a game like Cal Baptist was just like okay, that's not going to fly. So
And he also needs to understand, like, I feel like he's going to have to adjust to defenses viewing him as the primary outside threat. Like, they're going to try and take his easy stuff away, and he needs to adjust to that. That's also a micro concern of mine is, hey, you're the guy on the perimeter. They're going to be like, face guard him. Don't let him open. And he's got to figure out how to still get his shots up in the flow of the system.
Or be cool taking four shots. Yeah. Like, he's got to be okay taking four shots, and because that's what will be best for the team.
Or just be cool.
Have you not watched his Instagram feed? He's got a lot of photos of him not looking at the camera in some very tight-fitting gear, so he's clearly cool.
That's true. That is what cool is these days. So, in fact, that is why I am not cool. But let's go ahead.
I assume it's lit. That's what I've heard.
You know what was pretty cool? Beating Purdue at Purdue. But last year, Texas beat them and UNC. So, and on top of that, y'all were talking about Purdue and said maybe them figuring out their team without Carson Edwards is going to have them be a step back. Or I guess that wasn't you, Johnny. It was Tim and Jeff. What can we actually take away from this game going forward? And is it enough this game to say that Texas basketball is at least decent this year?
For the record, Jeff Haley is a scab. So
scab.
I think it's, I mean, clearly Texas is at least decent this year. And if we're going to take, if we're talking about signposts along the way, beating Purdue is a good signpost. It was the first test, the first real test of the year. The second lesser test was don't pull a Radford this year. Like, don't kill all your momentum from big wins by fucking up a game afterwards. And that's what this Cal Baptist game could have been if they had not done what they needed to do to win that game. So there's another one that's sort of a little micro marker that says, hey, maybe this team is, you know, better than last year. So, you know, I feel like that the question, I'm not going to say answer definitively, but we have results in a positive direction that say this team is better than last year. How much will remain to be seen, you know, by some of the upcoming tests. But even when they had a relative off night, they still ended up beating Cal Baptist by 13 points. So, you know, it wasn't always pretty, but it was a win, which is better than what happened against Radford and then VCU in consecutive games last year.
Yeah, and Will, to your point, is, you know, bringing in the UNC game from last year, like, that was, I mean, I don't know that we've seen, gosh, in my lifetime, what, maybe three or four games that are up there with how well Kerwin played in that North Carolina game last year. That was about as good as it's ever been that I've seen from a Texas player. Even like that would rival a lot of the Durant games.
Hot take.
It was very good.
It was very good, but let's not talk. Look, KD outscored Tech in a half. So let's not talk about like, well, it's maybe KD. Like, he might have been as good as the 10th best KD game.
All right, fine. The numbers were really, really good. It's fine. So, here's the deal with the Purdue game. We got shit on the boards. We took 16 fewer shots than they did. Courtney Ramey had 1 point. We had something like 16 turnovers. There were a number of things, if you look at that game, were reasons for us to lose. And we were on the road, and it was a full crowd, and Purdue played pretty well. Like, I thought Purdue played quite well for the most part. But we won, and we won from, like, really good execution, and we won from, like, really smart pick-and-roll play, and we were running, like, different ways, like, towards the end of the game where Matt had the dump off to Jericho, and then he found Liddell in the corner, and then he got penetration and kicked out back to Jace. It was like, oh my gosh, this is great. And our defense was solid. You know, like, it was kind of one of those things where we didn't win because one player took the game over. We won because we got, every time Purdue went on a mini run, we answered, which was awesome. And like, we answered as a team. And every time Purdue was ready to kind of put the game away, we got stops and we put points on the board. And that for that to happen on a someone else's home floor, when there were other things that we did so poorly and yet still played well enough to get it done, you know, that's not what UNC was last year, and that certainly is not what you then saw in the Cal Baptist game when we, you know, in last year, a very similar Radford team as far as like their ranking and stuff like that. Just, you know, we couldn't get over the hump, and then we did in the last one. So that to me separates it at least in that small 1v1 kind of idea.
Yeah, and Cal Baptist never actually led in that game, as opposed to Radford, which I think they led a pretty significant amount of that game, didn't they?
Was that? I don't know. I think Texas led almost the whole way, and then like the last 5 minutes, Radford.
Yeah, no, you're right. It was pretty close through most of the second half. So, yeah, you're probably right. Regardless, fuck Radford. Didn't happen this year.
So let's go ahead and get talking about the Empire Classic, because that is what is coming up in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, fuck the Empire Classic. I'm sorry. Was that? I'm on a roll. I just kept going.
Are we one of those Twitter accounts that just says fuck?
Yes.
Name.
Yeah, that's me. Every game, every tournament, everything that's coming up, it's just fuck it.
It's like A&M beat the hell out of.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Except classy, because I use the word fuck.
Yeah, exactly.
We got to earn that explicit tag on Podbean, so I'm trying to make my money's worth here.
Got to do it. So, Empire Classic, Texas is playing Prairie View A&M, Georgetown, and then either Duke or Cal, depending on how they do against Georgetown. Let's go ahead and break down each one of these teams, starting off with Prairie View A&M. We'll get that a quick look. Prairie View A&M is...
bad.
Okay.
Yeah,
Johnny, you want to expand on that?
Here is your goddamn
job.
Sure. All right. So, Prairie View A&M has one win on the season, and it's against an NAIA team. They're bad. If Texas loses this, it will be the worst loss of Shaka Smart's tenure, without question. They are bad. So, let's not fuck this up, guys. Because they're really bad. So, can we move on to the next team now?
Sure. I think that's probably not going to get... Well, real fast, before we get... Someone of my fun games this year. What's the over-under on the crowd at Prairie View A&M? It is a Friday night. So maybe it's actually going to be a good crowd, or it could be a bad crowd because nobody wants to go to a Texas basketball game on a Friday night. So,
2,600 people.
That's what I was thinking, like... I think there were 1,000 people at the game for Northern Colorado. I think.
Yeah, let's qualify this. I'm going to say like 3,000 tickets, you know, announced attendance is like 3,500. But actual people is going to be like, it's going to be first round NIT level sort of crowd.
Awesome.
Tim, do you have anything to say on Prairie View A&M? Or?
No, boy. I hope we win by like 35 or 40.
Okay, cool. So, let's go ahead and get to Georgetown then. What are we expecting out of Georgetown in New York?
They're probably what you would expect to be. If they were in the Big 12, they'd probably be picked towards the bottom of the Big 12. They're a team that has a pretty good offense down low. I watched their game online. I caught some online stuff against their when they played Central Arkansas. They actually were a little bit faster tempo than I would have thought. They pushed tempo some, and that wasn't exactly what I was expecting before the season started. You know, they do some things pretty well as far as, like, they get to the rim pretty well. They get to the free throw line a decent amount. They're defensively very solid. The rim protection is good. So, I think that they're going to be a team that you don't – it'll be a struggle to pick one or two things like that they don't do well, but I'm not sure they have any star players that are going to hurt us from a standpoint of, like, oh, can't let that guy take over. So, I think this will be a game where a lot's going to depend on not just, like, our rebounding numbers, but also – if Sims can stay on the floor for, if he gets 25, 28 minutes, I think that Texas should win that game relatively comfortably, 5-7 points. If he's not on the floor, things get a little bit dicier, particularly, when you figure that it's probably going to be a semi-away game considering, a D.C. team playing in New York City. And who knows what the rest of the crowd will do as far as like if Cal or Duke fans will cheer for Texas or not. I guess I doubt it, but we'll see what happens. So.
You mean Cal fan? Yeah. I don't think there's going to be a lot of Cal fans at this.
Although when I was in New York a couple years ago, when Texas beat the Hawkeyes and then beat, I want to say Cal, was that Rick's last year, I want to say? Because that's when Isaiah, yeah, it must have been because that's when Isaiah broke his arm in that game.
Yeah, it's been a while since then, and they have not been great.
So. Yeah, but there were more Cal fans there than I would have expected at the time. But yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, I think with maybe the Cliff Notes version way of looking at this is Georgetown is sort of like a worse Purdue in that they are sort of front court focused. They do have some senior and junior leadership that could potentially do something, but I think Tim's point is right in that Jericho Sims' minutes is going to portend a lot of things in terms of foul trouble, in terms of who is playing down low, because Patrick Ewing is recruiting and he's recruiting pretty well, but he's basically just recruiting bigs pretty well, as far as I can tell. So it feels like if they're not going to get a bunch of shots at the rim, then they're not going to do a lot. Like, I'm not as high on Georgetown as... I don't know. Some people are nationally, and I could be wrong, but I just don't feel like they're yet at like sort of, I'll call it fringe top 25 level. I think they're a couple steps below. And I think Texas like currently is favored if you look at like Pomeroy and stuff, and I think they should be favored somewhat. I think if this game was in Austin, it would be a 10-point Texas win, but if being that it's an MSG, depending on how Texas players react, depends on Georgetown fans, like Tim said, it could be a closer game. So it's by no means a sure victory.
What I'm hearing is we don't want this to turn into a game that is dictated by the big guys down low, because throughout this entire podcast, I'm hearing the main troubles with Texas are the front court, and the main troubles with Texas are the rebounding and getting shots, getting second chances at shots. And what Georgetown has been able to do, and the only thing they're able to do, is big guys.
Yeah, and I think they're going to out-rebound Texas probably by a pretty significant margin based on their offensive and defensive rebounding numbers to this point. So yeah, I think Texas is going to have to out-execute Georgetown by a fairly significant amount to make up for the lack of extra shots.
Right, and the numbers bear that out, where Georgetown right now has a 45.7 rebounds on average, and Texas is 34.7 rebounds on average. So, it's really early on in the season, but still, that's 10 rebound, 11 rebound difference.
Yeah, and if that's the number, like if Georgetown is plus 10 or plus 11, rebounding wise. Like, we're going to have to, like Johnny said, we're going to have to really execute well. Like, we're going to have to shoot well. We're going to have to be very efficient. If Sims plays a good game, and if Liddell gets some rebounds, and Ramey gets some rebounds, and we're like within 5 or 6 rebounding wise, then we don't have to be perfect. But in any game we play this year, if that rebounding number is, you know, gets into the 10 plus, that's going to mean, all right, well, we're going to have to really make up for that in a pretty big way elsewhere.
Well, one thing that's interesting about y'all talking about efficiency is Texas has been kind of on and off with their efficiency, especially when it comes to turnovers. I believe it was the Purdue game where they had 10 turnovers in the first half. Texas right now is averaging about 15 turnovers a game, which is too many, I believe. Is that cause for concern?
I'm going to say not yet. Like, if it continues, yes. But we're still sort of in the realm of small sample sizes. So I still generally trust Coleman with the ball, Ramey with the ball. Like, especially to Tim's point a while back of the rotation shrinking as we get into the bigger games. I feel like we're going to have less, you know, freshmen handling the ball or bigs handling the ball or random stuff like that that might help with that somewhat. So it's definitely something to monitor. I'm just not concerned about it yet.
Well, screw your small sample size, because every time Drayton Whiteside has seen the court, Texas has won.
So yeah, I'm just going to go ahead and that's a larger say. Sample size than this. So that's just math at this point.
Yeah, exactly. That you can't argue with logic and facts.
Yeah, it's like 9 games now that he's been in and they've won. That's 3 times the sample size of what you're talking about. So suck it, science.
So let's go ahead and take a look now at Duke or Cal. And do you all want to start with Cal here? You know, in the case that Texas does lose to Georgetown?
Or they beat Duke and Texas beats Georgetown, in which case that's the second most...
Do you really
most...
think Cal is beating Duke?
Hey, look, Evansville beat Kentucky.
Yeah.
So,
okay,
you know.
You're right.
Cal is not a good team. So if Texas faces Cal, they should beat them, because they're just not a good team.
Thank you again, Johnny, for your doing a wonderful job. Tim?
Hey, you wanted this to cut down on time, so Cal sucks. Move on.
Fuck Cal.
Fuck Cal.
Defensively, Cal's not particularly good. Watch some of their UNLV game. They give up the 3-point line a lot. They don't protect the rim particularly well. You know, they're a team that's got some athleticism. You know, and I'm kind of a fan of Mark Fox, as weird as that sounds. I've liked watching his teams in the past, so I don't know how, you know, I'm not sure in the long run how long it will take for them to kind of get where they want to be, but he's not a terrible coach. But I don't think if they are gonna overhelp and struggle finding shooters like I've seen them in the time that I watched them play this year, I think Texas should be pretty comfortable there again, because they're not gonna hurt you inside. They're not going to protect the rim in a way that would make us feel like, well, crap, what are we gonna, you know, how are we gonna put that together from getting all the way into the 10? So if that happens and if it is Cal, I think that, you know, that should be a very winnable matchup for a team that like us that we've got those 6 players that I think would probably be 6 of the top 7 or 8 players on the floor.
Let me put this in perspective. Cal went to overtime with a UNLV team where Elijah Mitrulong played 40 minutes and went 7-11 from the floor. Cal's not good.
Cool.
Elijah Mitrulong got 5 rebounds off of Cal.
That is saying something. So, is Duke good?
Pretty good.
Cool.
So let's move. Fuck Duke. Let's move on.
Duke will go. I don't think this is a hot take. Maybe it is. I don't think so. Duke will go specifically as Trey Jones goes. So I think that they are more dependent on Trey than it kind of showcases a lot of times, and maybe that you would think given the talent that is around him. But when you watch them play, that game against Kansas, like, he was just totally dominant. He was so dominant with the basketball. And Kansas had a shit ton of turnovers, but Duke just, like just really leaned on Jones the entire time. Now, the good thing with Texas for that is I think that Matt Coleman right now is our best defender. So I think you're going to see him on Jones a decent amount. And if that's the case, I think that we want to try to make Jones take some tough two-point shots because he's not a great three-point shooter. And so if we can kind of get him into some tough looks from two and force him to you know, struggle a little bit with that, and then hopefully he doesn't, like, happen to have a hot night from three, then Duke is beatable because they're going to ride him and his playmaking. And I think that he thinks of himself as the leader of that team, and if we can kind of put him in some tough spots, then we'll have a chance. But man, they're talented. They're super athletic, and they defend a lot better than you might think. And I just it'll be tough, and that should be a de facto, in some ways, home game for Duke, kind of no matter what, whenever they're that close on the East Coast. So yeah, I mean, so, like, for instance, I think there's basically 100% chance that if Javon Delorier had come to Texas, he would be, like, an unquestioned leader in the front court right now for the Longhorns. Whereas he's, like, the number nine guy for Duke. He's, like, the number eight or nine guy for Duke. And so, like, that's just a little bit of the difference as far as, like, what their personnel looks like as far as who they have as opposed to where we are. And I feel really good about our team. But it's a different level. But if we can get Jones into some tough spots, and Coleman and Ramey or whoever is going to guard him can you know, be equal-ish with him, then yeah, we got a shot for sure.
So, Johnny, nothing but good things happen when Texas faces Duke in New York, right? So what's it going to take for Texas to, you know, do well against Duke in New York? What does a win against Duke look like?
Is there an exorcist available? I don't know exactly what it'll take, because it just feels like anytime Texas faces Duke in New York, they are cursed. That's my scientific opinion, is that they are cursed. I think it's partly what Tim said. I think if Texas can limit transition opportunities, that will help, because this Duke team seems to thrive on athleticism and the ability to get out in transition. So that's going to be, if Texas can bog this down into a half court execution type game, they stand a better chance. And the fact that Duke is still a very young team. I mean, Trey Jones as a sophomore is one of the oldest guys in their starting lineup. So I think that as much as Duke has an athleticism and a talent advantage, there are ways in which a guy like Jericho Sims, being a junior and being sort of stronger and able to potentially put his opponent into conflict, could create foul opportunities, create free throw opportunities, slow the game down, and I mean, I think really if this game is played at Texas's pace, then they stand a lot better chance than if it's played at Duke's pace, because Duke has the horses just get out and run and get things going. So I'm really not particularly confident about this sort of matchup. I think the way I would put it is that Texas has a real opportunity here to go 5-0 and face Duke in Madison Square Garden. And if we're going to make this the season of burying or you know, breaking curses and showing progress, then Texas as a, call it, number 20-ish team facing Duke, who's in the top 10 in Madison Square Garden, and coming out with a win would be a massive statement. I don't know that they'll do it, but that's a really massive opportunity to plant your flag in the season and say, hey, we are actually here to contend for something.
That's the thing about college basketball, is the underdog has a lot better chance of winning. We saw it last year when Texas beat UNC. We saw it this week again. We talked about it at the beginning of the show. We see it all the time.
Beat Texas.
When Radford beat, that was, I don't know if that was really an underdog, but, well, you know, it happens. It happens.
So, really briefly, thinking about that game.
We
so,
don't do really briefly
again,
here.
I try. Against Cal Baptist.
Fuck really briefly.
The Coleman, Ramey, Andrew Jones, Jace Febris, Liddell, and Sims combined for 180 of the 200 minutes. Right, so the combination of Hepa, Baker, Williams, Ham, and Cunningham, those five guys combined for the other 20 minutes. I wouldn't be surprised if that number actually raises for our top six guys against Duke. I think we'll get a pretty clear idea against Duke for sure, and possibly Georgetown, what a shortened lineup looks like for Texas this year, because I think that at this point it's just so clear that we have the top six and then we're searching for who would be next. And so don't be surprised if we play them that the bench gets real short in that game.
Yeah, I think there's one piece of this that I sort of forgot to mention, is that if Texas remarkably shoots the three ball better and more often than Duke does this year. So maybe this is a game, if we're looking for ways for Texas to win this, maybe we Iowa State them, where Texas keeps answering twos with threes. I don't know that that's, again, I'm not talking about likely outcomes. I'm talking about possible outcomes here. And I feel like the fact that Duke does not shoot many threes, they don't, it's not really, I mean, it's part of everybody's offense, right? But relative to the D1 average, they take pretty few threes. So if Texas is able to get hot from behind the arc, if Andrew Jones has, you know, a 4-for-6 night, if Jace gets on track and has a 4-for-7 night, if you have a 2 or 3 guys like that get hot like that, this game gets gets more winnable. Not a lot more winnable, but more winnable. So there's a possible way of beating Duke, but I mean I am not predicting a victory over Duke until it happens, so let's just put it at that.
All right, so let's go ahead and get to everybody's favorite part of the show, pretend you're getting to know us. Enough of that basketball talk. Let's get into some fun hypotheticals. So if you could have an erotic painting of anybody in the world, you know, let's make it anybody in history. Who would it be, and where would you hang it?
So this is some recency bias here, but I saw a picture, like I happened onto a picture the other day of a young Martha Stewart. I don't know if you guys
happened
have,
upon. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever seen her when
happened
she was
upon,
young.
Upon, read, Googled.
Well, I happened upon it, and then I Googled.
A banana pudding, and I just happened to see this one of Martha Stewart.
Listen, I don't know what kind of degenerate you think I am, but you're almost for sure right.
No, you know exactly what kind of degenerate that I think you are.
Young Martha Stewart was incredible. Like, absolutely incredible. Like, staggeringly beautiful. And when I saw the picture, I was like, oh my God. And then I went on. I mean, there's no like nude Martha. Well, no like non-celeb jihad nude pictures of Martha Stewart. Right. But oh my God, she's.
Oh, that, I'm so happy that celeb jihad got a shout out on our podcast.
But she was just absolutely stunning. So I guess, you know, honestly, I don't know. I'm a happily married man, so that's awkward. Maybe, and then the classroom would be a very inappropriate place for an erotic photo of or a picture of the kind that the size that I would ask for.
And we're only going for the biggest, like in a mansion foyer, the mural.
Yeah, boy, it's tough. No one ever comes to our tennis meets for my high school, so maybe like at our tennis courts or something like that. No one will ever see it. That's a pretty clear way. But yes. Anyways, young Martha Stewart, smoke show, just absolute smoke show.
All right.
So in honor of my recent trip to Italy, I would like a photo of the Pope.
Huh.
An erotic photo of the Pope.
Hell, you know, yes.
Is it the current Pope? Are we talking the current Pope here?
No. Like, here's the thing. If we're talking like in a mansion, I want all the popes. I just want a series of them, like chronologically, starting most recently, like at the front door when you open it up. There's just, you know, spread eagle, like, you know, maybe
that's
do
Pius
it like
Pius the
a,
Third. Oh my God.
Yeah, not very pious in this photo. Yeah. Little known fact, the Renaissance popes, super into manscaping. So that's, I just want it. I want it from the front of the house going back into the living room so that when people come over for parties, although they may not anymore after these photos get put up, but it's just, you get back into like sort of the medieval times, like the popes that were in Turkey, they're in like their own room and just plaster all the walls from the front to the back. So that's
my
that's
house it. Is themed.
I'm having a flashback of the first time I saw that the Daily Show book where it had like all the Supreme Court justices naked or whatever in a line. So like there's Clarence Thomas who's like 270 and just a small penis or whatever. So
there you go.
Anywho.
Is it relevant that my dad called me an iconoclast in happy birthday letter they sent me. So this feels relevant.
All right. I think I'm going to lean into this one as well. I'm going to really go for like somebody who I think kind of defines sexy.
Courtney Ramey.
God damn it, Johnny. Fucking. All right. Second guy who I think really defines sexy. And that is none other than Danny DeVito himself. And you don't really have to look too far to find a sexy picture of Danny DeVito. I mean, okay, I know you could look at Batman Returns in the Penguin from 1992, but, I mean, you could get Roy the Stripper from Friends.
I was thinking, like, that scene from Always Sunny. Where
yeah, where he climbs out of the vagina.
The couch.
Yeah.
No, when he's in the couch.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah.
It's so hot.
There's
which yeah, also reminds
of the trash man
of when Ace Ventura climbs out of the rhino or whatever.
Yeah.
No.
Or you could also get my mind would just want like a big picture of Danny DeVito from the M&M Super Bowl commercial where he is just being a sexy M&M in a pool full of chocolate.
Nice. There you go.
There's just too many
great
Danny DeVito moments of him just being the goddamn sexy beast he is.
I feel like Danny DeVito's one of those actors that you could legitimately like you know, they've got the, what is that app where like D-list celebrities will say whatever you want for them, like you pay them like $500 and they'll wish your friend a happy birthday or whatever. I'm pretty sure you could get Danny DeVito like on that app to do that photo for you.
Oh yeah,
he seems like he'd be down for it.
Oh yeah. Oh, I mean, he definitely is the sexiest man alive, so you're just wrong if you don't pick him to put on your wall. When your guests come in, it should be the first thing they see is Danny DeVito in one of the many poses he had. And you can maybe it could just be like a picture full of Danny DeVito's, kind of like you with the popes, but it's Danny yeah. DeVito.
There you go. Yeah, just Danny DeVito. It's the Danny DeVito house.
Maybe house
make the front
themed.
Door like a goatsy of Danny DeVito.
My house is themed too, Johnny.
Nice. Well done.
So, again, hey, everybody who's listening, please tell me on Twitter, on Inside Text, on Barking Carnival, on Reddit, who is the sexy beast that you're going to put on your wall? Go for real. Go for, you know, very real like Johnny and I. But please let me know. I love hearing that from y'all.
We're the pragmatic people on this podcast.
Yeah, Tim going for the jokes. Tim, when will you learn to just be real?
Good answer.
Good answer. Thank y'all for pretending we are football for the past hour. I've been your host, Will Baizer. You guys can find me on Twitter at WILLBAIZER.
And Johnny Brashear, Mr. Bitter White Guy, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Bitter White Guy. I was active on Instagram while I was in Italy, and now I'm not there anymore, so I will go back into hibernation, but I am technically on there.
Cool, cool.
Also Barking Carnival.
Cool, cool, cool. Johnny, where in the world is Timothy Preston?
What you don't realize is that once he leaves this podcast, Tim is off to Antarctica to run a marathon. There's no support staff, there's no official course, and nobody else actually knows he's going there, so, you know, fingers crossed this works out well. Good luck, Tim, in your unofficial Antarctica marathon.
So, Tim, before you go to Antarctica, where can we find you and your stuff?
InsideTexas.com. Awesome community. Come hang out with us. We've got a lot of great basketball posters there. And then Twitter at InsideTexasHoop. No S. Loving the retweets. Just love them. Some of the best.
Yeah. Not quite as retweety as Johnny, but good. Pretty damn retweety.
A decent retweet.
Yeah. Decent retweety. Yeah. Mediocre retweety.
Yeah,
I refer to myself as a power user.
He certainly is that and a power bottom. Tim, where can we find you, though, on the basketball court?
Well, played on Monday night. That was awesome. First time back playing after a couple of months away, playing volleyball and some tennis. So good to get back on the hardwood. And, you know, just for some people, it takes a while to get back. But, man, it was immediate for me. I was just right back in my comfort zone. Really where I'm most comfortable is outside the arc, bombing away from three. But where I find that I really – where my comfort zone is highest is when I can get right into the rim with the big boys. But if you're asking me where I'm really most comfortable, it's right in your fucking face.
Beautiful. You guys can find us in our other podcasts on the Hornscast channel. That's the Hornscast channel on iTunes, Podbean, Spotify, Google Play. Everywhere you guys can find a podcast, you'll find the Hornscast. On that note, we'll see y'all next week. Hook 'em.
Hook 'em.
Johnny.
Hook 'em. Oh, he did it. He said it.
He did it.
He said it.